Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today, together with my co-host, Pat Schlarbaum. Thank you for joining us to listen in. Later in the show, Paul Wearson will join me for a road trip in search of stories about barns and bootlegging. But first, let's turn to Pat, who's also our nature reporter, reminding us that nature is not always just wildflowers and birds. Sometimes it's disasters.
Yes, Susan, this is quite a day with earthquakes and hurricanes. An earthquake did strike at 1:15 p.m. our time yesterday with a magnitude of 7.1, with its epicenter about 80 miles southeast of Mexico City. This was less than 2 weeks after a 8.1 quake killed nearly 100 people, and so far around 200 people have been reported as deceased. As a result of yesterday's quake, our empathy and sympathy and concern is certainly directed there in Mexico City for this morning.
Well, I guess the news that everybody's been watching are the islands, and we had plans to try to talk to somebody in the Virgin Islands, and then we called Puerto Rico, and actually the Virgin Islands, the guy in the Virgin Islands talked yesterday to Ursula, and but I guess that they've been hit today.
And knocked out today. I guess that's Hurricane Maria.
Yes.
Now. Well, this is a segue into our first interview this morning is with Director Mark Skouten with the Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. We kind of talk about Houston and some of the events that have happened here in Iowa. And let's go ahead and include Mark Skouten from West Des Moines, Iowa. Well, welcome to Local Talk, Director Skouten.
Very good to be here, Pat. Good to see you again after all these years.
Well, you were a level-headed kind of guy of the 60s when we met first in 69. And how is it that someone of your background and bearing becomes the director? And your full title, please.
Full title is I'm the Homeland Security Advisor and Director of Emergency Management for the state of Iowa. I'm a member of the governor's cabinet and was appointed by Governor Branstad to serve in this position.
And Homeland Security, pretty viable topic of a lot of people's concerns and interests. And let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think emergency management started out as the old civil defense and the duck and cover, the Cold War, the risk of nuclear attack. And then after 9/11, it really expanded to include Homeland Security. And so now it's a combination of both the traditional natural disaster, emergency management, and Homeland Security, since in many instances the consequence of, say, a terrorist attack can be very similar to those of a natural disaster.
Is it fair to say that you are one of 50 emergency preparedness directors, so it's all hands on deck?
Indeed, it is. And so the issue is, can one state have enough resources to deal with all types of catastrophic events that may affect them? Rarely does a state have all those resources. And so 10 years ago, the states got together and decided, I think we need to form an organization or set up a process so that if one state is affected by a disaster and they do not have sufficient resources to respond, the request can go out to other states, and those other states can send their resources, thereby supplementing what that affected state has to deal with its own disaster. I think it's worked well over time. It enables a given state to leverage its response by using the resources that fellow states have.
Well, there seemed to be quite a community response. A lot of people with boats. There was a lot of search and rescue, it seemed like, that was handled locally.
Absolutely.
And boy, what a fantastic concept that I guess until our backs are against the wall, we really can't fathom that, or we can't predict that.
I think that is exactly how the system is to work. The standard principle in emergency response is that all disasters are local. They all start at the local level. They end at the local level. And it is those local resources that are first brought to bear to respond to the disaster. And as those resources are found to be insufficient, then people from other counties and other states or other communities or the National Guard, some instances the federal government, the U.S. military comes in and assists those local authorities in responding to that disaster. But in all instances, the disaster begins locally and it ends locally. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great deal of local control in how the response is done, but rarely does one community have all the resources to deal with these major disasters. And so they reach out and they bring those resources into bear on a problem that is maybe narrowly geographically, but a huge problem for that area and one that they don't have the resources to handle. Took me a while to understand and appreciate that. It's difficult to actually manage a disaster unless you understand it well and you are on the ground to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so we spend at the state level. We will activate our state's Emergency Operations Center when there is a natural disaster, but the purpose will be to accept requests from local coordinators who say, we need A, B, C, or D. And so we, through our catalog or our cafeteria of available services, and we call the DOT, we call the DNR, we call Department of Public Safety and say that Winneshe County or Bremer County needs A, B, or C. Can you help provide those resources after the governor has declared a disaster so they have legal authority to take their equipment, take their employees, and help respond to this disaster?
Well, and there's certainly, in a sense, a role for our community radio stations then. It does strengthen a community to have community radio.
Well, and it's exactly, and your point is quite well taken, because it is awareness. So much of it is being weather aware. Information, I believe, is best communicated locally with supplementation, maybe from people at the county or the state level, but the best work is done at the local work. And we've seen it going out with the governor after disasters. The local organizations, the local first responders, the local volunteer organizations, they go to work so quickly and work so diligently. It's just a true credit to those communities on how they themselves have responded to those disasters. They may not be able to do everything. They don't have all the machinery. They don't have maybe the expertise working with FEMA that the state can bring to bear on those problems, but they're out doing the initial cleanup work and doing it well and doing it fast.
Were you able to visit the McGregor site with the recent tornado that went right down Main Street?
Indeed, yeah. I was there with the governor and the lieutenant governor the morning after it happened. It was a bad event, a lot of damage, a somber event, a wet and dreary view.
Well, predictability seems to be a cornerstone in preparedness to your program. Climate change weaving its tentacles through your agency.
We see the need for predictability. We see variability in weather. The town of Sumner had 10 or 15 inches of rain, a couple months ago flooded out the entire town of 2,200 residents. We've seen some very significant rainfall events, nothing like maybe 2008, maybe 2011, but we have as a state our share of disasters, and we have a far higher than average amount of natural disaster damages. And whether that's climate change, what the cause of that is, we don't know. We see the weather variability. But 2008 was the biggest disaster that we've had. In fact, we are just now finishing up the FEMA public assistance work that has flowed from that 2008 flood in Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls, Parkersburg tornado, Little Sioux tornado.
While I hear talk of a Green New Deal, is it time for a paradigm shift of our focus? What would be the benefits of becoming a bit more proactive in our planning for these variable events that
yes.
seem to be happening?
We have spent millions of dollars buying out houses of those owners who've had their homes flooded one, two, some instances three times, who've said, I've had it, I want to move. Will you use FEMA dollars to buy out my home so that in the next big flood that happens in our town, our home won't be there to be flooded? We will have moved to higher ground. And so we've been very active in doing that, in mitigating the effects of future flooding. By the same token, we have used FEMA dollars to build tornado safe rooms, so that if a tornado strikes a school, the kids are in the safe room rather than the school itself. I think Iowa spent some $50 million of FEMA hazard mitigation dollars in mm-hmm. constructing safe rooms throughout the state, primarily mm-hmm. with schools. And so mm-hmm. Iowa, too, has had the legislature 3 years ago passed a law that created the Iowa Flood Mitigation Board that allows increases in sales tax from a local community to be used for flood mitigation projects. And so the legislature allocated, or has allowed for the allocation over the next 20 years, of $600 million to be used to mitigate the effects mm-hmm. of flooding. And so there are 11 communities within the state that have passed projects ranging from $200 million mm-hmm. to use that sales tax increment that would have otherwise gone to their community now goes to the flood mitigation projects, in many instances mm-hmm. to retire bonds that have been issued in order to fund a major flood mitigation project.
And where are we at with Houston? Are we going to just go ahead and rebuild everybody's flooded home and hope that it doesn't happen again? And yeah. how's that going to work?
Yeah, Pat, that is the very delicate balance between fixing or repairing property that has been damaged in a flood only to have it be flooded again, or mitigating the effects or taking steps to prevent that sort of flooding from happening in the future. And so, similar to Chelsea, the governor, lieutenant governor, and a number of people from our staff were in Vinton 2 years ago observing the flooding there, and we were with the local emergency manager, Scott Hansen, who pointed to areas saying, see that green space there? 6 years ago, there would have been houses that would have been flooded because the water is there. And so there are some areas that are just prone to flood. And I think we need to be slow to invest the public a dollar into rebuilding in many instances if it's only to be flooded again. University of Iowa, case in point, Hancher Auditorium. Big argument after 2008, should that building be repaired where it stood, mm-hmm. or should it be moved to a higher elevation that's going to avoid flooding in the future? And after a long argument with FEMA and the Office of Inspector General, there was approval given to tear down the old Hancher, build the new one at a higher elevation, and I think it's built at an elevation that we're not going to worry about flooding in the future. There are people living in those homes. It's horrible. I mean, they have suffered through the floods. You can see it in Houston right now, and talking to those folks at FEMA are trying to set up their framework to go to work down there. Those are huge issues.
Did you have a message for...
Well, I would want to speak about the HUD Housing and Urban Development HUD Resiliency Grant that Iowa was awarded maybe a year and a half ago, $96 million, to work with local watersheds to try to mitigate the effects of flooding at the watershed level. But I think historically, what we've attempted to do is protect cities with levees and dikes and put the work into the cities and have accepted the fact that this water is coming from the watersheds in increasing amounts and hitting the cities. Now I think what is happening, and it's been the Iowa Flood Center and others that have done this work, where they are attempting to slow peak water flows at the watershed level. And they found with edge of field practices and certain different ways of planting and harvesting crops that they can create a 25%, some instances 30% reduction in peak water flows during a major flooding event. If they can reduce those peak water flows at the watershed, those benefits are increased as you go downstream and that watershed gathers more water from a broader geographical area. The most amazing thing, I know they will say this, they have said it, when they reduce peak water flows, they also reduce nutrient flows because the nutrients quite obviously travel with the water. And so there is this dual purpose or dual benefit in reducing peak water flows. You can reduce the flow of nitrogen and phosphorus too. And so I think we are on the kind of on the frontier, the leading edges of really shifting the flood fight from the cities where the consequences are seen to the watershed where the problems really begin. And so this is going to be a five-year project working closely with IDOLS, working closely with Iowa State. The Flood Center is closely involved. But I think the next 5 years, we're going to learn an awful lot about reducing floods or flooding and rainfall events at the watershed level. And I think that'll be important knowledge to have. And I'm not sure anybody else in the nation has it.
So here we are, 2017. We were products of the 60s. There were some principles. We were going to change the world. Do you feel like we're accepting that mandate or that philosophy of, I think we can do better?
Yeah, I would agree, Pat. We can all do better. But I think in our own ways, as we each look back over our own lives, I think we've contributed in different ways, particularly the two of us, and knowing you back at Iowa State in 1969, and it's just so difficult to measure it, but nonetheless, I think we've done it.
You're a steady hand at the helm, so.
Thank you.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was the director of Iowa Homeland Security, Director Mark Skouten. And I am your reporter today, Pat Schlarbaum. And for Everybody's interest. We do have an update on Hurricane Maria, which is approaching a Category 4 storm and approaching Puerto Rico. It's threatening lives and promising potentially damaging economic damage. The island is already deep in a years-long debt debacle spurred by mismanagement of funds and archaic energy policies and a struggling economy. Puerto Rico's government owes $74 billion to bondholders and an additional $50 billion in pension obligations to teachers and almost all other government employees. In May, it filed for the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Meanwhile, Puerto Rico faces another long-term problem. Many residents are moving from the island for the mainland United States, leaving it with few skilled workers to handle the rebuilding and development process. So the territory's population was down to 3.4 million residents last year from 3.8 million in 2004. Persistently high unemployment along with better job opportunities in the mainland U.S. has pushed Puerto Rico to pick up their bags and move. And so we've got the pace is picking up. In 2005, nearly 47,000 Puerto Ricans left for the U.S. territory. And we are and they're ready to experience another hurricane event. So calamity and a lot of necessity to rally around the Puerto Ricans in our communities. It's a tough one, Susan.
It's a tough one, but it's really ironic because of accidents in our imperial history. Puerto Rico is part of the United States.
Exactly.
All those people are citizens.
Exactly.
We welcome them with open arms, unlike anybody who's got a problem in Mexico.
Well, this is – it's going to have to be all hands on deck. It's going to – it's
in,
a, it's
in
a
Puerto
really,
Rico,
a,
that's
really
right.
A crisis, yeah.
Yes, and we need to remember Puerto Rico.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so for the last half of our –
For the last half of our program, Paul Wearson and I will share with you the road trip that we're calling Bootlegging in Barns. We're starting out as we usually do when we get into the car. This time I'm picking up Paul at his farm on E18 near Story City. I'm driving in my Prius, so it doesn't have the comfortable hum of his 1996 Buick, but it's just as good for country roads that we'll be traveling to the Malish Barn near Zering. Good morning, Paul. It's going to be a beautiful weekend for all the events taking place. The one that's taking us on the road trip is the 17th annual Iowa Barn Tour on Saturday and Sunday, September 23rd and 24th.
And which barn are we visiting today?
It's the Malish Barn near Zering.
Well, then we just turn right out of my driveway and head east on E18.
We'll be meeting Mark and Malish there, and she'll give us a brief story about the barn's history and tell us about how you can learn about the rest of the barns on the tour.
Well, for me, it's just a great excuse to drive around the Iowa countryside right now in the fall with all the changing colors.
As it turns out, it is also a great follow-up for the story to go with my interview with Linda Bensinger McCann regarding her book, Prohibition in Eastern Iowa. Barns were great places for hooch to be stored, and Roxanne may have some stories about that.
Well, Prohibition in Eastern Iowa? Why not in Western Iowa, where Templeton Rye is located?
As we drive along, I'll play you a little of what she said, but the fact is she could write about Eastern Iowa because she knew the people there, and they'd talk with her. In Western Iowa, she was an outsider, and even after all these years, people involved or even their children who might know something refused to tell about it.
Well, now that sounds pretty intriguing. Let's hear what she had to say.
Well, I was up in Denver, north of Waterloo, talking with a group of older ladies, and I was talking to them about a book I had written on the electric train. There was an electric train, a trolley, that ran from Waverly to Cedar Rapids for over 50 years. And that was the first off-topic book I wrote because I was able to talk to people that had ridden it and how it had changed their lives and that sort of thing. So as I'm talking to these ladies, they begin telling me that after Prohibition, when they were about 8 or 9 years old, their activity was to go to the depot in Denver on Saturday nights and watch the trolley come in. And they explained further that this was when each county chose if it was wet or dry. So Blackhawk County was dry, Bremer County was wet. And so the men were riding the trolley from Waterloo to Denver to get their supplies. And so they were telling me all kinds of stories, and I love having these stories. I love hearing them. When we finished, their activity director came up to me and said, "What was Prohibition?" And I kind of looked at her and thought, "Really?" And so I explained it to her. As I'm driving home, I'm kind of thinking, I wonder what my daughters know. My daughters are both Wartburg College graduates. Well, they knew Al Capone, they knew the Untouchables, and that was about it. So I began asking, "What is there somebody I should talk to about Prohibition?" Everywhere I went, I would say that. And every night I would go home with a list of people to call about Prohibition. The interesting part is, two guys refused to talk to me. And this was about 5 years ago, and yet they won't talk about it. And the one guy was very polite. He just said, "There's family still alive. I just don't want to talk about it." And I said, "You don't have to tell me names. Just, I want the stories." No, he just didn't think he should talk about it. The second guy panicked when I called him. "How did you get my name? How did you get my phone number? What makes you think I know anything about Prohibition?" And this is when I began realizing there's something going on here, you know. Well, I have a son-in-law that's a deputy sheriff. And so I said to him later, "This guy really was strange." And my son-in-law thinks about it and he goes, "Well, the statute of limitations has run out on everything but murder." And I said, "Give me a break. This is Iowa." Well, we did have murders.
One of the things, though, that surprised probably everybody when Templeton Rye became well known and their story got into the papers was that Iowa was a liquor-producing state and that it was spread out among small farmers.
Well, and, you know, there again, well, I know Iowa farmers made liquor way back in the 1880s. They used some of their corn products, and so they didn't have to buy it, you know. It was just a way. Then, especially during Prohibition, the farmers did go into making liquor because the corn prices dropped from $5 a bushel in 1919 to a quarter in 1923. So farmers did begin using the corn to make liquor, and it truly was to support their families. And even during Prohibition, they could make it. They could just not sell it. And so people could make enough liquor for them, themselves. Again, you know, how much do you need for yourself? But it was the selling that really was illegal. And I have done research and talked to people. And actually, Al Capone had a brother who was a federal revenuer. And he was in Nebraska. And this brother and Al Capone made an agreement. The brother would not come into Iowa, and Al Capone would not go further west than Des Moines. So, you know, your western Iowa was actually a no man's land for them, and that's where the Templeton Rye is. There is no proof anywhere that Al Capone ever had Templeton Rye. But in eastern Iowa, if you wanted to have liquor, you could find it. If you didn't, you thought nothing was going on. And what kind of got me on that thread was one day I was reading an old newspaper, great big words, "Attention. If you're looking to purchase liquor, look for a car with one headlight." That's a moonshiner telling you he has liquor for sale and it's safe to approach him. And I found it in at least four newspapers in northeast Iowa. And again, it's like, who put that in there? But that's how you got it, you know. Then I was over in Gutenberg, and they said, oh, no, we didn't do it that way. We put tape on our headlights to make a cross. And again, that told you you could purchase liquor from them. And I think that's it. You had to find out what was in your area.
And what about the farmers?
There again, it's tough to get anybody to talk. But this son-in-law, who's a deputy sheriff, one day called me. And he said, do you know anything about a mail route? And I said, no. And he was talking to people, and they told him that their grandfathers had talked about putting money in their mailboxes on Saturday night, and on Sunday morning they would have liquor in the mailbox. Now, they were claiming they did not know who did it, but this is how they got their liquor. Well, just so happened I was in the same area a few weeks later, and I asked the people I was talking to what they knew about this, and the people in the town knew nothing about it. And that's where it kind of clicked with me again. Okay, this is how one farmer was probably selling his liquor. He was selling it to his neighbors in maybe a 4 or 5 mile area, and nobody talked about it. You know, they kept it quiet. And I think that's the biggest thing that today we have trouble understanding, is that people don't go out and put it on Facebook. You know, they kept secrets. They knew they had to.
You said that there were some murders and some violence. Was this in Northeast Iowa?
And it truly was all over the state. Until about 1925, Prohibition went 1920 to 1933. And actually, Iowa went dry in 1917. Again, we had a vote statewide and voted to go dry. So Iowa went dry in 1917. The nation went dry in 1920. And about 25 is when the mob moved into Iowa. And they came into Iowa because we had this supposed good liquor, you know. Iowa's liquor was supposedly known to be good stuff. Well, the mob came in about 25. And everything changed. That's when the murders happened. That's when the gunfights happened. Before that, a Dubuque County sheriff wrote about that he did not pick anyone up in these early years because these were his friends. These were his neighbors. They might even be his relatives, who all they were trying to do was support their family by making liquor. And until the county board of supervisors told him he had to enforce the law, he didn't pick anybody up because he knew this was how they were supporting their families. Well, like I say, about 1925, the mob came into Iowa, and things changed. You know, they didn't care who they hurt or how they hurt them. You know, they just wanted the liquor trade. And they actually came in. I spoke with two guys who their fathers had made liquor. And the mob came to them and said, you're working for us now. One of the fathers said, no, I'm not, and he got out of it completely. And the son can remember how times changed. You know, they didn't have money, and they couldn't get money because there were no jobs. The other farmer said, okay, and went on making liquor and selling liquor for the mob. And his son then went on to tell me how his father was making so much money that he was able to buy up the neighbors' farms when they lost them. You know, again, this is the late 1920s into the 30s, and farmers are losing their farms because they can't pay taxes, as simple as that. This farmer had the money to pay the taxes, so he truly became the largest landowner in the county because of buying these farms that were being lost to foreclosure. Well, this guy says to me, and this guy was probably in his late 60s, early 70s, he said, all my life I heard about how my father stole their land. He said, I got into fights over it. It was just everybody blames my father. He said, then my kids went to school, and they heard about their grandfather stealing their farms and this sort of thing. And this guy has a tear running down his face, and he says, my grandson came to me a few weeks ago, and he said, Grandpa, what did you do to steal their land? And he said, it was my father, his great-grandfather, that bought the land, supposedly stole it. But he said, now my grandson's going through this. And he said, truly looking back on it, I wish my father had never done it. You know, it's just not worth it.
This is KHOI, and Paul Wearson and I are taking a road trip to the Malish Barn, one of the barns on the Iowa Barn Tour, taking place this weekend, October 23rd and 24th. I've just played an excerpt from the interview with the author of Prohibition in Eastern Iowa by Linda Bensinger McCann, who will be at the Jasper Winery this Saturday from 11 to 5 p.m.
Today we're talking with Roxanne Malish. We're here near, well, it's near Ziering, Iowa. It's out here in the country on a gravel road. And we're in a beautiful barn that dates back to 1904. And basically, we're talking about the upcoming barn tour this weekend, September 23rd and 24th, sponsored by the Iowa Barn Foundation. And Roxanne, you're involved with the Iowa Barn Foundation.
I am. I am a Story County rep. There are a couple of others, but I am one of them. And I just want everybody to come out on our tour this weekend. We're open from 8:30 until 5:30. There are five barns in Story County that will be on tour.
This is one of those barns.
And this
right?
is one of them. This is the one at Ziering. And
now, if they go to the barn tour, where do they report to do the jump off?
This is all, you go in your own vehicle at your own pace, go to whatever barns you want. There are barns open all over the state of Iowa that have received grant money from the Iowa Barn Foundation.
So now they could go to a website, and that would be the Iowa Barn Foundation, and they would see all they need to see for the tour this weekend. It would give all the information and where the addresses are, the GPS, and all this sort of thing.
That's correct. And there is a map on there, and it goes by counties and gives directions. And it's really easy to go onto our website, which is www.iowabarnfoundation.org.
Wow, .org.
Uh-huh,
well, .org. This is going to be both Saturday and Sunday?
Both days. We are open to the public both days. My barn happens to be an award of distinction barn, which are some of them. And it's up to us whether we're on tour, and most of us choose to be.
Well, why don't you tell what the award of distinction is about?
The award of distinction is if the owners have done the work or paid for the work done by themselves rather than getting a grant. But most of the barns on tour are grant barns.
Now, you might explain, indeed, what the main purpose of the Barn Foundation is.
The main purpose of the Iowa Barn Foundation is to save barns and to promote our agricultural heritage in this state, especially to the young people that perhaps have not been as familiar with barns and farms as some of us older people are more familiar with barns. It's a good chance to teach young people about our heritage and get to see some really interesting barns. There's a couple in Story County. I would say the Hansacker one is especially interesting. It's different than what I call your regular barns.
Well, I myself moved back to the family farm I grew up on. My career was in Des Moines. I happen to have a big crib and a big barn. Both barns and crib will turn 100 in 2019. And so my concern, as probably a lot of barn owners are, is the roof of these structures, and explain how that impacts the preservation of a barn or an old crib.
The roof is the most important part, that and the foundation. You really need to get the roof done, and you can do that by applying for a grant from the Iowa Barn Foundation, and the grants are up to 50% of the cost. And if you get the roof in good condition, the rest of the building you can delay a little bit. But if you let the roof go, it won't be long and the whole barn will be gone.
Is there any kind of roof that is not permitted? Are metal roofs permitted?
Metal roofs are permitted. Asphalt shingles are, or wooden shingles, of course, are maybe the preferred thing, but metal is okay. No metal on the sides, though. The rest of the building has to be kept as much close to original as possible.
So the Iowa Barn Foundation, and they're sponsoring a tour this weekend, that's September 23rd and 24th. You can go to the website, which is iowabarnfoundation.org, get all the information, and you could just follow the directions you see on that website.
I'd like to put in a plug for the website because it's a virtual tour. Not all the barns do they show the interiors, but many of them, they show details of the interiors, and sometimes they show pictures of before and after. So if you're planning to go on the barn tour, it's wonderful just to see which barns you might want to go to.
This barn is just so similar to our barn. Typically, a barn will have ours has a milking area and then an area right across an alley that's about 7-8 feet wide because the farmer would go down the alley and feed the animals. Mm-hmm. And then there's always a hayloft. We have at least two chutes in ours.
Yes.
And my barn's probably about 35 feet high. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big barn.
Yes.
And we always had we milked 11 cows until the early 50s when most farmers got out of it. Now, this is kind of unique. The local theater group stores all their sets in my barn. My barn's still being utilized.
That's interesting, but, because my barn had a play enacted in the haymow of the immigration of my husband's family to this country.
So you had a play in the haymow. That's fantastic.
Really,
now, there are other legends about barns in Iowa, and many of them have to do with the Prohibition era. And the bootlegging that went on. Have you heard any of those stories?
I have. I have several Prohibition stories, not particularly here at this barn, but at another farm up north. And I do have a lot of Prohibition stories of hiding the barrels of, what did they call it, hooch or something?
Hooch.
Okay. The hooch was all made and ready to take to the delivery point. And my great-grandfather got the idea that he should bury these barrels in the hog pasture.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, because he didn't want to get caught with all these around the buildings. He buried them, obviously not very deep, but he wanted to dig them up the next day to take them to the collection point. He went to bed, and the next morning he got up, and all of the barrels were on top of the ground. The hogs had rooted around and rooted them all up. And so
the hogs blew his cover.
They certainly did blow his cover, but he did get the hooch delivered safely.
Now, on a different segment of the show, we have a woman who's written a book about this over in eastern Iowa. So that must have been statewide because farms, number one, were remote. Mm-hmm. Number two, they had storage areas.
Well, what I heard was that the place to make it was the grove, and that the revenuers could spot it sometimes because of the bees.
Yes, that's true. And my Prohibition stories do occur in Illinois Grove, which is a defunct town. I mean, it's a ghost town, but during Prohibition, it was already a ghost town. But my family owns a farm there, and it was well known. The Illinois Grove town and area and timber was well known for having a still, maybe more than one still.
Well, you had a story about a little boy.
Well, yes, it was a little girl, and her father did disappear. Apparently, I mean, he was a well-known bootlegger in the area. I did talk to her. She's elderly now, and she told me the story that her father disappeared for several days, and the bad guys took him and kidnapped him and to scare him, I suppose, and took him and dumped him out somewhere, and he walked back, and it took 3 days. He was gone 3 days, and the story also went that, and my great-uncle told me the story, that the bad guys came and shot up the house, and the mother and children stayed in the basement for 3 days, and then the father came back and they moved. And I asked her, you know, more about the story, but she was only three at the time, and she said they didn't talk about things like that much back then, and even later on they didn't ever say things like that because it was illegal. And they didn't discuss that, especially with their children. But everything she said did collaborate the story my great-uncle had told me.
And did they stay in that house after it got shot up?
They moved. As soon as the father returned, they moved. And I said, well, maybe that was because of the bullet holes in the old house, because she did not remember the house being shot up. She did not remember that part, but she said, oh, even at three, she remembered her father being kidnapped.
Well, this is a beautiful barn. And it's supported by several timbers. And you had to do that because the weight of the hay, especially after we began baling hay, was tremendous. And I remember we used to put hay all the way up to the rafters. So the These timbers supported a great deal of weight. The whole haymow weighed tons and tons and tons. And then you have a silo out back, too, where silage was stored, and we had that. As a boy, I remember climbing up in the dead of a winter night to shovel the silage down the chute so we could feed it to the animals.
And thus ended the road trip to the Malish barn, where Paul Wearson and I talked with Roxanne Malish and earlier with Linda Betsinger-McCann. And both of those are involved in events coming up this weekend. There is a barn tour, and if you want to find out more, go to the iowabarnfoundation.org. Saturday and Sunday, 8:30 to 5:30. And Linda Betsinger-McCann will be at the Jasper Winery from 11 to 5. We'll close out our program now with Evan Taylor telling us about Maximum Ames Festival. It's this weekend. Five shows will be at KHOI from Friday to Sunday. Check out the website, MaximumAmes.com. Evan Taylor, KHOI's operations manager, spoke with one of the artists who will perform here, Ebony Tusks, for Lawrence, Kansas Mishap.
Hello, this is Evan Taylor, one of the co-hosts of Behind the Board. The following is an excerpt from my interview with Marty of Lawrence, Kansas hip-hop trio Ebony Tusks, who will headline a concert at KHOI during the Maximum Ames Music Festival on Saturday, September 23rd. In this segment, Marty and I reminisce about Ebony Tusks' performance at Maximum Ames 2015 and talk about what we look forward to at this year's festival. I still recall that super high-energy performance that you guys put on at the now-defunct Iowa Music Store during Max Ames 2015, and that still sticks out to me in my mind as, like, one of my very favorite just, like, small concerts that I've ever been to. It was so, like, intimate. I mean, there were so many people just stuffed in that tiny space, and you guys were just performing your hearts out. It was truly a beautiful thing to witness.
It was great to be a part of, and thank you again for the compliment. And you really hit the nail on the head. I think our desire as live performers, really the heart of it is, trying to create memories, for ourselves and for the people in the audience, and making sure that it resonates on a much deeper level. Like, I had two things, and I'll start with that show in particular.
Sure.
Is that I sort of made a somewhat reckless decision, like, early in my child's life to decide to go out on some weekend runs, to go out on tour with Ebony, because I felt like that's what we needed to do at that point in time. And that particular weekend was really difficult, to say the least, to be away from home. So I came into that show feeling really sore emotionally. Like, I was really, really having a hard time that night. And we made a decision that after the show that we were going to drive back and, just make that trip back to Kansas City and then for me to Topeka that night. And so... Mm-hmm. Knowing all of that, Bill was just having like a really tough time getting excited for it. But like, just knowing Nate and everybody else in the Maximum Ames family, I've been so blessed to like know him for so many years back, meeting him at Ames Progressive and some other young people that grew up in the Ames area that always hosted Cowboy Indian Beer when we came. So for me, it was just like, I had already been having conversations with him along the line of like, I appreciate like the exchange that we've been able to have. Our communities have been able to have these few years, and we're honored to come back to Max Ames 2015 and play. Like, we just want to be a part of what you're fostering. And he recognized that and gave us a chance, and it meant so much. So to be there and to see Secret Freedom and to get to know Mr. Nasty.
Yeah, definitely.
To get to know them as a band, but also to get to know their front man and also like his sense of urgency for community as well. Like, we were just so honored to be in that space, and to feel like the full weight of like what Maximum Ames meant, like to pick up those vinyls and see Christopher the Conqueror, or the Poison Control Center, who I used to play with a ton, and mm-hmm. that just to see, like to be in the, you know, to be in the room. Like, it's just, again, it's just like transformative. Like, this is the blood, sweat, and tears that, you know, a group of musicians, you know, a group of people put in to their community, and to the state of Iowa. I couldn't have been more honored. And that really, like, changed my spirit about, you know, how I was feeling. And we were able to still have, like, a really powerful, intimate show, and one that I have fond memories of as well. And to that point, I had a conversation with a friend of mine in Lawrence. Like, he was on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And we both talked about having these types of shows where you wanted, like, a lot of crowd engagement. And you would do anything to get that engagement, you know, and he just talked about, like, you know, I just want, you know, if, you know, I bring this projector and sometimes I get up on tables and it's just like, I want people to look at me. And I told him, like, I thought about it for a second and I realized, I told him, so for me, it's like, yes, like, I want you to look at me. But then when you look at me, I need both of us to look up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I'm trying to get us to tap into something together, not just for you to feed me, but for us to be fed mutually by, you know, by this higher thing over our heads that is more important than us even in this moment, you know, just getting people to recognize, like, who they really are, you know, again, just like manifesting that truth. And doing anything you can to get that, because, you know, I don't know, you know, we could book shows 18 months in advance.
Right.
will we be there to play those shows? Who knows? You know, we've only ever had to cancel maybe two or three shows in the 7 years that we've been together.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, tomorrow's not promised. So while we're here today, let's do this thing. Let's do this thing at, like, it's the last time. And that's what the approach is, you know. Every time we're doing it, like, we might not get to do it again. So,
absolutely. And what do you have in store for us this year at the station?
You know, really, just trying to double down on on what we came with in 2015. We got to play the Winter Classic at Iowa State University.
Yeah, at the M-Shop, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it was so good. It was so good. It was such a pleasure to be a part of. Like, you know, Moonbi Kasumba.
Oh, yeah, she's
on the
great.
Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then the old lead frontman from Poison Control Center. Remind me of the name of his project.
Oh, yeah, that's Patrick Tate Fleming, and he was playing as Gloom Balloon.
Yes, Gloom Balloon. Yes, Patrick. Yes. And again, you know, just like that was another situation where you're just in the presence of artists who just really love what they do, in a room full of people that are really connected with that. So for us, it was an honor. So, like, I'm grateful that we're able to follow that up with a second show in Ames this year. I come up to KHOI, like, really looking forward to getting to know your radio community, and really looking forward to a great lineup. Yeah, we have some new songs since we played in 2015 for sure. Definitely, like, we've been recording for over a year and a half.
Yeah.
And so we're coming up hopefully on the tail end of it, trying to get it all, as much of it finished by the end of October as possible. So you never know. We might air one of those out. We'll see.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll see. Yeah, either way, it's going to be, you know, the same toughness that we're coming with. So hopefully people will be ready to meet us with some holler backs. So
for sure. Yeah, I'm so looking forward to it. All of the field recorder plugged into the board and everything.
Oh,
so
God.
Hopefully get
that'd
you
be,
a couple of that'd clean be so good live recordings that you can do with as you please.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been your host, Susan Franz, and together with Pat Schlarbaum. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Mark Scouten, Pat Schlarbaum, Linda Betzinger McCann, Roxanne Malish, and my road trip companion, Paul Wearson. And just now, we heard from Ebony Tusks from Lawrence Mishaps.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOY at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Today's show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come in and join the Local Talk team.
Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening.
And we'll see you again on the radio. Funding for KHOI comes in part from the Octagon Center for the Arts, bringing you the Octagon Art Festival with original artwork, live entertainment, and a variety of food. Information is available at octagonarts.org. That's octagonarts.org.